On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Fans of the television series Bones may not realize that it was a career of Temperance on Bones is actually a reflection of the real-life career of the author Kathy Wright. She won the Arthur Ellis Award for Best First Novel in 1997, was an international best story. Her new book, The Bone Code, is Kathy's 20th entry in her series, featuring forensic anthropologist Temperance Brennan. Kathy was also a producer of Fox TV's longest-running scripted drama, Bones, based on her work and her novels. One of the very few forensic anthropologists certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology, Kathy Reichs divides her time between Charlotte, North Carolina, and Montreal, Quebec. And she is here to talk about her latest, the 20th in the series of the Temperance Brennan novels, The Bone Code, from Scribner. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
People who we're going to encourage to pick up a copy of your newest novel, people who have not read your novels before are in for a really terrific surprise. First of all, that Temperance Brennan is the main character, that she is based on your actual life. And as a matter of fact, her residences, at least in the 20th novel, are reflect of your own dual residency in North Carolina and in Quebec. There are characters that if they expect that this is a Bones novel, that they will be surprised.
Well, if they're expecting it to be exactly like the Bones TV series, there are some differences. And I think of TV Tempe and Book Tempe. And Book Tempe existed way before TV Tempe.
Right.
She's a bit older in the books. She's not quite as socially awkward as TV Tempe. She's in the Carolinas in Quebec and not at the Jeffersonian in Washington, D.C. But the main premise is the same. She's the same character, really. She has a passion for her work. She really feels strongly about justice for the dead. And she works identifying dead that are compromised. So a regular visual ID isn't possible, or a regular autopsy isn't possible.
The daughter that she has on the TV series in the novel is all grown up and serving in the U.S. military. So in that sense, this is taking place a little after the series ended, say, where Tempe was at that point.
Yeah, you could look at it that way. The TV Tempe is like a prequel to the book Tempe.
Ah.
Yeah, it's a little bit earlier in time. That's one way to see it.
Okay.
Now, she works with Seeley Booth instead of Andrew Ryan. There are some differences, but as I said, the main premise is the same. Solving murder mysteries using forensic anthropology.
And the book starts out much as the TV series did, with mysterious skeletons showing up in a weird situation, or at least it seems like to those of us who are not in the crime business, it seems like kind of a scary, odd thing. Two skeletons rolled up inside plastic, inside a plastic storage bin dumped in the ocean, and we take off from there, right?
Exactly, and we used to sit around. I wrote some of the episodes of the TV show, and we'd sit around in the writer's room when we'd be breaking the story for a new episode, trying to figure out new ways to open the show, because we always opened a show with a body discovered in some compromised state somewhere, and we'd say, yeah, let's put it, squash it in the bleachers of the gym. Oh, wait, no, we did that season two. Or, okay, let's have it in a chocolate bar. Oh, no, we did that season seven or whatever.
Yeah.
So exactly, the opening of this book with the two, they're actually decomposed. There's more than bones in there, are inside a medical waste container that is thrown ashore by a hurricane in Charleston, South Carolina.
Right off the bat, we find out there's going to be a mystery to be solved. There's not very much... there's not very much physical evidence. In other words, there's not an intact body or anything like that. No clothes or no, you know, remnants of things. And so we know it's going to be interesting. And this time, novel Tempe has a friend who's living in a situation where the hurricane's about to come crashing ashore. She's worried about her friend. And this is a different friend than TV Tempe has, too. The dual national sort of situation, I think, is very interesting, not the least of which because this is the situation that you actually have.
And she's gone down to help her friend because of this, and her friend's a little bit flighty and gets a little bit hysterical about damage due to a hurricane. So Tempe goes down to Charleston to help her, and of course the coroner finds out she's in town and asks for help with these two bodies in this medical waste container. And as Tempe is doing the analysis, she notices some alarming similarities to a case she worked on in Quebec 15 years earlier, two bodies washed ashore in a medical waste container. So eventually she decides she really does have to go back up to Montreal and open this cold case. And as she investigates on both ends, we see some disturbing links and some disturbing a disturbing situation involving a contagious flesh-eating pathogen that has a flare-up in Charleston.
Now, there's also kind of an interesting thing that happens, and we're not really sure for some time what relationship she has to what else is going on, but there's a woman who comes in looking for family evidence of twins and identical twins. And this seems to be unrelated, but nothing is ever unrelated in a good novel, right?
Yeah, and it's the theme, the thread that runs through the novel, and that's where the title comes from, The Bone Code, has to do with the genetic code. The human genome is fully mapped now, and we have tools to actually modify the human genome using CRISPR. This book began... Again, in the writer's room, we used to have what we would call stories ripped from the headlines. And that's how this one began. I saw a little article in a newspaper or online, probably, about a Chinese doctor who, against all agreement in the medical scientific community, decided to go ahead and alter the genomes of two unborn baby girls. And everyone had agreed, we're not going to do that. We're not going to use this knowledge and technology just to make designer babies. Well, he did it. So I read that and I thought, well, there's a great idea for a fictional situation. What if someone did that for nefarious reasons? What if this? What if that? What if that? And that's where that core idea came from for the storyline. And the genetics, the fact that identical twins have identical genetic makeups, the theme of genetics runs through and the genome runs through the book.
It's always the challenge whenever I get to interview somebody who's written a novel, how much we want to talk about without giving too much away. Because we want people to buy it and read it and do as I did, wait till the practically the end of the book and go, oh, that's it. That's what you want as a novelist. And so we don't want to give too much away. But can we talk about the fact that you basically invent sort of a pandemic situation, which certainly make it interesting for everybody reading this year, because South Carolina, in your story, has this weird new disease that's showing up, and it's apparently fairly virulent. That is to say, it is easily communicable, seems to have appeared from nowhere, and nobody can figure out how in the world it's showing up and why it's showing up.
Yeah, and the irony of it is I wrote this book. It takes 2 years. It takes a year to write a book, and then the book is in production for a year.
Right.
So when I started this book, it was way before COVID. We hadn't seen any indication of COVID or a pandemic. So the book was finished, and we were in the final stages of it, and my editor said, you know, maybe because it came out post-COVID or in the middle of COVID. Mm-hmm. So my editor said, well, maybe we should, you know, at least acknowledge that this thing that happened to the world. So I went back and I inserted references to COVID, which had come and gone in the Bone Code. It's already over with. But when I started it, there was no idea of a pandemic.
Interesting. Since I had opportunities to interview a lot of people over the last year who've written books about pandemics in general, about that one specifically, about the development of the news coverage, et cetera, I've had a chance to learn, not a lot, of course, but much more than I ever knew about how many pandemics had been. I mostly knew about the 1918 Spanish flu. I knew about the previous ones, bubonic plague and so forth, the Black Death and all that. But I didn't realize that there were that many really serious flu epidemics that took place between, say, the polio vaccine when I was a child and the Wuhan flu, as they called it at first, the COVID. So I think most people don't realize that there have been things that have been on the periphery, and as long as it didn't get the kind of worldwide coverage or the worldwide dissemination, most people didn't realize that there were pretty serious flu epidemics in the United States, say, in the late 1960s and the mid-70s and so forth, mm-hmm. unless they were directly affected. So when you were putting together this weird flu and so forth. Did you get the ideas from those kind of things that had come before then? I mean, I'm thinking since you did it before COVID, certainly you knew about this other stuff as a forensic anthropologist.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be an influenza virus. I wanted something that could be contagious, that something, and it's a real disease. Capnocytophagia is a real disease. Most people, it's a bacterial infection that is in the mouths of dogs and cats, and most people can get scratched or bitten. They have no reaction to it. But some people have a lethal reaction, and it's like a flesh-eating contagion that they get. They begin to lose limbs and lose their nose and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, that's perfect. That's what I'm going to use. And then let's look and see if there's a genetic component to it and why all of a sudden all these people who normally are immune to it, why are they suddenly getting these absolutely severe reactions to it?
Well, this is interesting, too, because the week that this interview will run on the bookshelf on WTBF, the week prior to that, we had a visit with somebody who's writing about DNA testing. And so there's an element of that in here, too, that the direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies, Ancestry.com and 23andMe and so forth, have become wildly popular, which we learned about by talking to her, Libby Copeland. So that it showed up in your novel as well, I thought, this is very interesting, because this people who listen to me regularly, see, this will teach them to listen to me every week, they what they learned in that interview, they can apply to the information that you have in the bone code.
Yeah, you're talking, I'm always looking for new developments in the forensic sciences, because I don't want to just write about anthropology in each of my novels. Every book uses a different aspect of forensic science, a different expertise. They're murder mysteries, but it uses those sciences to drive the solution. And one that was just beginning a couple of years ago when I was starting this book is forensic genealogy, in which people use data that has voluntarily been put into these public databases and combine that with genealogy research, and they can find suspects. Say there was, and all kinds of cold cases are being solved with this now. If you have, you know, bodily fluid DNA from a crime scene, you can now use that, if you can get enough DNA from it, see if you can get a match in one of these, you know, DNA and me, 23andMe, whatever, and then do the genealogical work to work up through the generations and back through the generations and see if you can narrow to a suspect.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Kathy Rice, who is the number one New York Times best-selling author of the Temperance Brennan series. Now, the 20th novel in the series is now released, The Bone Code. It's from Scribner and is available online and in bookstores everywhere. And once again, Tempe Brennan, as Kathy says, this is novel Tempe, not TV Tempe. They're related but not identical. In this novel, she's dealing with all sorts of fascinating things, including a pandemic, the human genome, genetic testing, and as usual, very strange things that are showing up, and lots of twists and turns. So if you're thinking this is going to be a quick read, forget it. You're going to sit there and read until you get to about the last page and go, oh, okay. Oh, now it makes sense. I love that in a novel. I don't want to be able to figure out in the first three pages. I want to think, oh, it's this, and this, and then find it. Nope, not even close. Great red herrings. That's what you want as a reader when you pick up a novel. So this is lots of fun. And knowing the character from the TV series is fun, too, because then you can kind of visualize her and at least get sort of a sense of her. Now, I would like to ask you a little bit about your career, not as a novelist, but your medical career. There are not a lot of certified forensic anthropologists around, are there?
I think we're up to around 130-something. Not everybody's still alive and practicing, but that many certificates. It's a tough row to hoe. You have to have a PhD. You have to submit your credentials. You have to be admitted to candidacy, and then you have to take a very rigorous two-part exam to be board certified. So that's why there aren't a whole lot of us.
Okay. And do you work? Obviously, you can't take everything you do in real life and turn it into your characters' cases, but have there been cases that you've worked on that kind of gave you an idea or a direction for Tempe to go?
Oh, absolutely. My first book, Deja Dead, was based on a serial murder case that I worked on in Montreal, and it had some very interesting serial murder case and dismemberment, so it had some very interesting elements. So we learn a lot about saw mark analysis, saw marks in bone, in that book. So a lot of my books are based on, of course, I change all the details, the names, the places, the dates for legal and ethical reasons. But I do take that central core idea, and then I ask myself, well, what if this and what if that and what if that, and spin it into fiction.
One of the things that drew me to your novel was, of course, that I recognized your name and I recognized the name of your character, but I had also seen, I knew that you were a novelist before this because I'd seen paperback copies of earlier novels and stuff, and I bought them for my wife. I found them at the bookstore when Bones was on the air and thought, hey, you might want to read these. These will be fun. And when you finish reading it, let me read it. That's what we kind of do. And so when I got the opportunity to read this novel and to get a chance to talk to you, I thought, this is great fun. But now I feel embarrassed that this is the first of your 20 novels that I have gotten around to reading. So I don't want you to think the only reason I read it is because they sent me a copy. I've been meaning to read the others, but I never got around to them. Now I'm going to go back and say, okay, if you haven't read those yet, I'm going to read them first, and I'll tell you what to watch out for. You have lots and lots of loyal readers. Do you get comments from people that say, hey, why is Tempe this way in the book and she's not that way on TV? Or is that a huge issue? Or people just kind of understand that this is kind of different takes on the same character?
I don't get that anymore. When the show first went on air in 2005, I did get comments about, wait a minute, why is it different? This isn't the same. She's in Washington, D.C. She's not in, North Carolina. Not as much anymore. And I would suggest, just think of the TV as a prequel. And people would go, okay, there's some differences, but, you just have to live with that.
Yeah.
And people were good with that. People were good with that. The series went 12 years, so I guess we're still the longest-running scripted drama in the history of Fox, so I guess we were doing something right.
Pretty cool. So how did you come to live in two different countries and work out of two different countries, if I can be bold enough to ask that question?
I went to, it's a funny story. I decided, I was teaching full-time at university here in Charlotte, UNC Charlotte, and I decided every educated person should speak French. So I took a French 101 class, Je m'appelle Kathy, very humbling. And then we got this offer for something called National Faculty Exchange, NFE, a professor at one institution changes places with a professor at another institution.
Right.
So there was a man in Montreal who wanted to come to Charlotte, and I thought, well, may we. I speak French. I can do this. So off I went, and while I was teaching there at McGill and at Concordia, the lab approached me because they wanted a board-certified forensic anthropologist and one who could speak French. So I started working at the lab, and at the end of the year, we just struck up this arrangement whereby I would go back and forth every 6 weeks or so. I would commute between the Carolinas and Quebec.
Well,
long commute.
Yeah, boy. I'd hate to see what it's like in that 5 p.m. traffic rush. So I think that's really fascinating. I've had a chance. I teach journalism at the local university, and I've had a chance to teach two-week stints in Kuala Lumpur a couple of times, which is very interesting. It's a lot of fun to get to meet your students that have been online with you for part of the semester and to see them face-to-face. And after you've gone more than once, then you have the same students in different classes. That's quite fun. But I can't imagine how very interesting it must be to zip from one place to another every 6 weeks or 6 months or so. Do you have to keep a car in both places and all of that? Or
I did that for a while, but it is a bit of a the weather certainly is different. It's always a shock when as it is for Tempe when she gets off the plane and leaves the airport terminal, how cold it is. Mm-hmm. The language, of course, is different. It's predominantly French in Montreal. Culturally, it's much more European than Charlotte, North Carolina. So it's different on many levels.
Getting back to the book, back to the Bone Code, Tempe is developing the connections to find out more about what's going on inside a pharmaceutical company. And this is very interesting to me, how new vaccines are developed and so forth. Certainly after COVID, it's more interesting, but it's interesting even without that. I guess most of us that are not in the medical field just think there's a couple of very, very smart people sitting in a lab somewhere going, hey, I wonder if this will kill this. And they inject it into a mouse or something, and it works, and they go, oh, great, hey, I think we can sell this. But it's enormously more complicated than that, correct?
It's enormously more complicated than that. And when a vaccine is finally approved by the Food and Drug Administration or whatever the government body happens to be, it's going to be safe. And, so I go into that a little bit and the different traditional techniques of vaccine production. One of the challenges when you're writing, putting some science in your book is you got to keep it brief and you got to keep it jargon free, mm-hmm. and you've got to keep it entertaining. You can't just do it as, you know, long, boring narrative.
Well, for example, there are some vaccines that originally were developed in eggs, say, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are some problems with that, right? People is it egg allergies or what else? What can cause problems with it?
Well, I'm not an expert in vaccine production, but there are differences in cost. There are differences in the speed with which you can do it. Yeah, there are differences in, do you want to do it in you know, a live animal? Do you want to do it in a chicken egg? Do you want to do it, you know, with the mRNA technique, which is different altogether?
Right, right. Certainly, since you work on a novel, you write it, you go through all the production stuff, then it's finally released. Obviously, you don't just sit around the rest of that time going, well, I just think I'll take a year or two off, and then we'll get on the circuit and we'll pump.
Yeah.
What I've discovered that most novelists, as soon as one is sent off to the publisher, immediately start working on the next one because we all have this habit of eating on a regular basis. So I'm assuming,
exactly,
you know, you've already got Tempe in some new and wild situation. Are you working on novel 21 already, or are you working on novel 22?
I'm on 21. We have a tentative title, Cold, Cold Bones.
Hmm.
I'm well along, not as far along as I should be, but don't tell my editor that.
It'll be our secret.
But it will, and it should be due out next summer.
Okay. But so is there basically about a two-year turnaround from I'm writing my novel to I'm showing people copies of my novel? Is it about that?
Not 2 years for me. It's a year, and
okay.
I pretty much write it and don't show it to anyone. I just, when I turn it in, it's complete.
Huh.
There is a point along, I don't know, there does come a point earlier on that they need a title, and they need a synopsis, mm-hmm. so that they can start doing cover art and marketing and that sort of thing. But
right.
I'm not someone who sends off chunks and asks for feedback on them.
Obviously, with your 20th novel in print being out right now, obviously they don't have to worry about, is she going to be able to hang in there or not? You know, or is she only got a couple of good chapters in her, and that's all she's going to have? At this point, they're pretty much sure that they've got a real good connection going on with.
Yeah, and I'm very conscientious about deadlines. I'm fanatic about deadlines, so I'm pretty good about.
I think that makes the best kind of person to have doing a project like this. I must say that I have talked to a lot of people. I've been doing the show 30 years now, and I've talked to an awful lot of people that write books, and it drives them crazy when they're dealing with other people who are supposed to be helping them who don't get the cover art done, say, when the book is ready and they're still going, well, I haven't, you know, been inspired enough yet. So I can imagine that you can't be a novelist and just be cavalier about it. You've got to be pretty dedicated and write a certain number of pages every day and all that, I know.
Yeah, I do it by hours. You know, I put in a certain number of hours each day. And I have a wonderful publisher, so I've never had issues with the cover art or anything like that not being ready. They're right there when I turn it in.
Well, that's excellent. I want to say,
anything
else that you want to tell us before we go?
Well, I hope they enjoy The Bone Code. It's out there. Go buy it. It's in its first week, and I hope they enjoy the story.
Excellent. And websites, social media sites?
Yeah, KathyReich.com is my website, and there are links to where you can purchase the book or any books. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, Kathy Reich, at Kathy Reich on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram.
Kathy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been lots of fun reading your book. Now I'm going to go back and find the other 19 and read them.
Very good.
And thank you for taking time to talk to us today.
Thank you for talking with me.
Our thanks again to Kathy Reich, the author of the Temperance Brennan series. This is number 20 in the series, The Bone Code. It's from Scribner. And once again, if you're like me, and prior to this book coming out, you might not have ever read the previous books and just know Temperance Brennan from the TV series Bones, which was based loosely on the life and career of Kathy Reich, and because she is an actual certified forensic anthropologist. You'll find some things in this novel that will be very familiar to you and some things that will be a little different. Think of it as being set a decade or so after the TV series, and that will probably help you to feel comfortable with it. But in any case, you're going to really enjoy it because it's a lot of fun and it's got a lot of twists and turns. And of course, a little bit of ick, because that's kind of part of the deal when you're talking about forensic anthropology. Websites, social media sites?
Yeah, KathyReich.com is my website, and there are links to where you can purchase the book or any book. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, Kathy Reich, at Kathy Reich on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram.
Thanks so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast if you're listening to us on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.